Good evening, and welcome to Off the Bookshelf Radio. This is your host, Deborah Herman, and this week I have one of my all-time favorite co-hosts. You guessed it, Jeff Herman. Jeff Herman, the literary agent. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, of course. Just never far away.
Yeah, you're not far away. We won't tell people exactly how close you are. But I always love to have Jeff on the show because he brings a great perspective to some of the topics that we discuss. Even though Jeff and I have been together with the Jeff Herman Literary Agency for many years, he is still much more on the agenting end, and I am much more interested in finding and developing projects. And together, it's a nice combination. So we are going to talk about a lot of different things this evening. This is a live call-in show. I will announce the phone number shortly. But we want to talk a little bit about topics of publishing. This past week, although I'm not sure when some of you will be listening to this, as it will be archived, but this was the 2013 Book Expo of America. So we have been attending these for many years, but it was a little different this year. We were there the day before set up, and then I was able to actually watch at least one of the lectures live streaming on my computer, which is certainly something we wouldn't have anticipated years ago. So, Jeff, what were your impressions? How does the BEA differ now than when you started as a literary agent?
Okay, well, first I'll say it has stabilized. You could say that it was sort of in free fall for several years. It used to be called the American Booksellers Association Fair, and that's the name of the trade group, the private trade group that runs it every year. The American Booksellers Association. It's not the American Publishers Association. This is an organization that was formed by booksellers. And when we say booksellers, we don't mean the middlemen. We don't mean the agents or the editors. We mean the actual bookstores. And going back to the origins of the American Booksellers Association, most of your bookstores were actually mom-and-pop stores. Scattered, there were thousands of them, and some of them may have been small franchises on a citywide or a regional basis. But what happened over the years is that the booksellers, like many other industries, consolidated, and it became more and more of a corporate business to be a bookseller. That's now reversing for various reasons. But what happened was the mom and pops began to disappear. And what was known as the superstores, like the Barnes and Nobles and the Borders, which is now a name from the past, and other chain names, began to dominate market share. And they were able to get much better prices, like Walmart would do, and underprice the competition. And then because of technology, the reason for the ABA was really because of the lack of technology. It was a way for all these mom-and-pop booksellers to congregate in one place every year and see what was going to be published the next year. It was literally a trade show.
So I'm thinking it reminds me when I was a little kid, I used to go with my father, who was worked for various companies, to the gift show. Now, of course, as a kid, that was an amazing place because we were able to get samples and things like that. So, and that was a trade show for all of the gift stores to buy products for their upcoming year and for the Christmas season. So really, I remember there was a chain, Little Professor, there was a chain, B. Dalton. I'm not sure when those stores started to appear. But I know that, to me, those were actually small bookstores, but I guess they were also chains.
There were hundreds, if not thousands, of stores throughout the country with those names, but then even they eventually became non-viable for all kinds of reasons, probably because Barnes & Noble was able to get the best locations and consume all the demand.
It's amazing, yeah, because now the Barnes & Noble stores are experience stores. I mean, they have cafes. They have it almost seems unfathomable that a bookstore could be as large and could be an anchor to major malls throughout the country. I mean, when we were younger, I won't say we're, you know, dinosaurs, but I just don't think I ever could have fathomed an entire store devoted to books and products like that.
Yeah, and the actual books may become less and less an important part of the revenue stream, the way these stores are now being modeled. And the reason is because most of your new releases, which generate most sales, it's the books, the new books, people are preferring to buy them as digital books because the price is much lower and because they're becoming more and more accustomed to reading them on electronic readers, which are now quite good. That wasn't true even just 5 years ago. So places like Barnes & Noble are desperately trying to keep themselves relevant as a place where you need to go to buy a book, because you really don't need to go to a Barnes & Noble to buy a book or any bookstore to buy a book. You can get it if it's only available in hard copy because it's an older book. You can get it through any digital reseller, like Amazon. So what they've now done is they've created an experience, as you're pointing out, where they probably very often have a Starbucks and they have other kinds of products. And then they're hoping that on an impulse level, you will see a book that you like or you'll start browsing. And that because you are there on an impulse level and the environment, the merchandising environment they create, you will maybe spend $50 to $100 buying books.
You mentioned that there are mom and pops that are sprouting again.
Yes, they're making a big comeback.
And talk more about that.
Well, what's happened is because the big stores, the big box bookstores, really overplayed their hands and they couldn't compete with each other. Barnes & Noble, you can say, won the game. So places like Borders, which had at one point several thousand stores, basically had to disappear. So what that did is it created a lot of room in smaller markets where a Barnes & Noble is no longer that accessible to start making a comeback. So it's now become economical for a mom and pop, an individually owned bookstore, to open up in a strip mall or even in a regular mall, a store which doesn't have a whole lot of overhead, which has modest rent, so long as there's a Barnes & Noble not any closer than 10 to 20 miles, the mom and pop can compete and can actually – the mom and pop may not become millionaires simply from being a bookstore, but they can maybe be doing something that they really love, and they could probably make a very nice living.
So this generation would still like a physical book. But we don't know what will happen as the children who are being, you know, born now, they expect a lot of multimedia experience. So, I mean, I think I'm a holdover. I love physical books, and I also, you know, use the iPad and the Kindle, but I really love the feel of a physical book.
Yeah, the generation that has not yet been born may be the generation that really decides that the physical book is archaic and more of a problem than a benefit, and even in an aesthetic sense, because it's paper and it collects dust and needs to be put somewhere. And it may really be that there is no aesthetic purpose anymore for physical books to exist, say, maybe 50 years from now. What's holding it together now is really just inertia. I mean, our generation, you know, you and I are over 50. And, you know, our
generation.
Speak
for yourself. I don't relate to that. I'm getting younger.
Right. I mean, we like books. We may use Kindle, but we still like books. And I think people over the age of 20 have still have a certain familiarity with books. And not, believe me, not all bad, you know, only a fraction of available reading material has been digitized. I mean, there's still a lot of good books that have not been digitized, you know, that you have to buy as a hard copy. So it's, I think we have maybe another 50 years to play this out. And it may be that the generation that's not yet born, they may think that books are fine, that they're cool, that let's keep them around because it's a cool thing to also have. It's tactile and they can be visual.
Yeah, kind of like how I taught a class about The Tipping Point, the Malcolm Gladwell book. He talks about the hush puppy shoes and how certain tastemakers and hipsters started wearing them. They were getting them from the vintage shops. So people started buying them because they thought they were cool. And now hush puppies is back in the black. So maybe books will be, you know, tomorrow's hush puppies. But we're doing a lot of interesting ventures. So I want to talk a little bit about that because we kind of went digital a few years ago, in spite of what I ever thought we would be doing. I liked the internet, and I guess at that point had been on Facebook, but I certainly wasn't someone who used it for more than research and word processing. And a couple of years ago now, we launched WayNet, Writers, Agents, and Editors Network. And now, very soon, by July, I'll be launching Off the Bookshelf, the self-publishing website. So we're interested in staying relevant because we talked about it. Readers are going to read and writers are going to write.
Yes, and the content is always going to be there and the market is always going to be there. And if you are a reader or a writer and you want to stay commercially viable, you really need to understand all the formats now and be prepared to deal with all the formats. And that's not a content issue.
No. One of the things we are going to be doing with Off the Bookshelf is making it a place for readers as well, because we're going to be curating the material. There are going to be a lot of new voices of people who are choosing to self-publish. However, on the site, even though our conversion software to upload an ebook or a POD, that's all free, we're encouraging people to, you know, use editors. We're educating people so that the product is a better quality product, something that could be in a mainstream bookstore. And also, a lot of people who may have been former clients or just people we've met over the years who know about Off the Bookshelf are choosing to self-publish. You know, they, even if they've been in traditional publishing for years and years, they're planning on going this route.
You know, and in this, I just want to bring in a little sidebar, which is provocative, and I think it's relevant. You know, we are still going to be offering print on demand through that. And there was, in yesterday's New York Times, there was an op-ed piece by the individual who founded WikiLeaks, which is an organization that basically dedicates itself to hacking government and corporate secrets and then releasing them to the world, which is now in a lot of hot water. And what he was saying, which is counter what everyone, which has been the movement over the past few decades, last couple of decades, what he was saying is actually digitization of entertainment and information is going to have diminishing returns to the point where it's going to become government again. We're going to have government and corporate and cultural control over all digital product because it's easy to do. And what that means is there's going to be a counter movement to go back to paper, old-fashioned paper printing, because that's going to be the place to be countercultural and the place to be innovative because it can't be censored anymore. And so it's interesting how that could really sort of turn upside down the pyramid of which is the most powerful way to achieve freedom, which up until now, the way to bypass government or corporate or whatever cultural obstructions has been through digital publishing, because you can put anything out there very quickly through the internet. But it was his article was saying that it's going to have a diminishing effect in the next few years. So I just wanted to put out there that print publishing may have to make a comeback simply because it becomes the least viable way to regulate what's being said and printed.
Well, but that being said, I think a writer is wise to be right on time, because that may be because he's hacking into government documents and they're watching him. But I think the average writer and the average reader still has great opportunity by using the internet to find each other. I mean, China, of course, shut down, I think, Twitter or Facebook or something, but we live in a free country.
Right. So, but in China, there is no digital freedom.
Right. But we live in a free country. So if we are aware of – it goes back to apathy. It goes back to people being aware of the infringement of our freedoms on all levels and becoming more educated. We have more information available at our fingertips now than ever before. I would have killed to have access like I have now, where I can type in a question in Google and get my answer in seconds, because I'm a naturally curious person. So I think just in agreeing with what you're saying, it's really important for every person who is literate to watch things like this and to be aware of the need for us to protect our freedoms and to be aware of, you know, the leaders we put into power, to respect our rights to vote, because we need to express our voices. You're silent.
Oh, no, I was taking that in. So anyway, on a commercial level, if you're writing your romance novel, you probably don't have to worry about these things too much.
Unless you're revealing a true story or a scandal about a government official, you know, I mean.
What I was saying is there may be reasons why print publishing is going to remain very important. Like we were just saying a moment ago, China, there really is no digital freedom. And you're taking a lot of chances in China if you run a blog, if you're Chinese and you live and you're running a blog which goes against government policies, there is no way you can run a blog probably and not get busted. But you might have a better chance if you print a pamphlet and distribute it, leave a pile of them in the KFC somewhere in Beijing, you know. So as technology increases, the old technologies may actually you probably don't have to secretly ever publish a non-political romance novel no matter where you live, okay, unless, you know, there's something provocative about it on a cultural level. But I'm just saying that the necessity for the old-fashioned low-tech way of publishing may have reasons to stick around that have nothing to do with economics.
You know, I think it's wise if anybody can get a hold. Remember those old mimeograph machines? That was about as low tech as you could get. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they smelled bad.
No, actually, some people thought they smelled good.
Really? I always thought they reminded me of a dentist office, the way they
smelled. Yeah, but I think that those were the kids, the ones who used to smell the mimeographs. I think those were the ones who went on to sniffing glue and
oh, no, they were all in sped with me.
Yeah, really? Yeah, but you didn't sniff the mimeos.
It was unavoidable. If you were the kid that was designated to hand the crap out, you know, the papers out after they were printed, they'd get all over your fingers and in your blood and, you know.
So that explains it.
Oh, yeah. That's why I have purple blood.
Oh, I thought it was because you're an alien.
No, no, no. It's because I had to distribute the mimeographs.
Okay. Well, I see that we're getting off topic. So there's a good future for whatever it is. Content is content. People want to write. People want to read. And we're just, whatever it is, Jeff and Deborah Herman, as always, we're going to try to stay ahead of the trend. We're going to try to report what's going on, and we're going to roll with the punches and roll with the tide, because that's the best way to keep on top of the changes and trends in publishing. You have to be on the internet. You have to get used to it. It's there to stay. And as we've spoken about on several of our shows, it's good to learn about social media marketing. We're not going to talk about that tonight, although I did go back to Rutgers and did learn some new things. We don't have to devote this show to that. Oh, I forgot. This is a live call-in show, and the number to call, if you have any questions for Jeff and Deborah Herman, you can call toll-free at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. There are other numbers, but I think start with that one, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
You know, getting back to the BEA, I wanted to make another comment, and this was not something I had an opportunity to observe, but it is something I read about this year's show. Is that there were a much greater number of micro publishers who had a display booths at the BEA. And the American Booksellers Association, to their advantage and to their benefit, has made it much more economical for small presses. When I say micro publishing, I mean a publisher which may have 100,000 or less in revenue, which sounds like a lot of money, but you know that's actually small revenue for a book publisher. And they were pointing out that there were dozens more, maybe 100 more, of these kinds of small, tiny startup publishing companies with displays at the BEA this year than there were last year, which helps, you know, fill up a lot of real estate so it doesn't look as empty as it had been looking in the past, and helps bring in more people who have to work the booths and so on. But what that shows us is that a lot of these micro publishers, I have found, actually began as self-publishers. And as they began to self-publish and they began to learn their skill, they realized that they could expand what they're doing by publishing books for other people, even if it wasn't yet their full-time job to do this. A lot of them have kept their day jobs, and this is something that they're managing to do after hours and on weekends, because technology enables you to work at 3 in the morning as capably as you might at 9 in the morning if you are physically able to do it. And what it also shows is that the so-called self-publishers are really becoming the most quickly growing segment in publishing today. In terms of sales, they're the most fast growing, and in terms of creativity, they're the most important segment. Now, self-publishing may still represent a very tiny percentage, maybe less than 1% of the books you're going to see in a bricks and mortar store like Barnes & Noble, because they are not hungry to open up relationships with all the self-publishers. There's too many and they don't know how to deal with it. But the trend is there, and the big publishers know it. And that's why the big publishers have now started to open up their own self-publishing engines so that they could begin to compete with this burgeoning market of self-publishers.
The problem with that, as I've been reading about and talking to people about it, is you know, again, what we warn people about when you go to what's actually an author services company,
and that's different.
That's a little bit different, because if you're going to self-publish within a publishing house, there should be no expectation that somehow that house is going to pick you up and give you a contract and make you a traditionally published author, because that's it just doesn't work that way.
No, you have to pay the tab.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes with some of these publishing houses, the tab is extremely expensive. Whereas you might
there's a menu.
Off, pardon?
There's a menu. It depends what you click on the menu.
Well, but some of them offer you have to buy actually a package in order to pay to play. Some of the companies have a menu where it's less expensive. I think people are starting to catch on that the reason they were going to choose one over another is because they had the expectation that they were going to be somehow singled out and that possibly they could get a traditional publishing contract that way. And, you know, we try to educate writers in how to approach a traditional publisher. The reason to self-publish, if your goal is still to be picked up by a traditional publisher, is to establish a market, to sell books, to utilize a marketing plan, build your platform, find an audience, because then if something really has legs, then you can either be picked up by an agent or a publishing house will find you. But if you're going to go spend a lot of money hoping that this house is going to pick you up, that's not always a good use of your resources. You'd be better off, you know, paying someone to help you build a marketing platform or to properly edit your book. You know, there's only so many resources, and there are other ways to approach traditional publishing. Would you agree?
Yes. The bottom line is, and a lot of writers who give money to third parties to publish them are in denial about this. The bottom line is, if you are paying the so-called publisher to publish you, you are basically doing an old-fashioned vanity publishing deal. Now, it may not cost you a lot, and it may work out just fine, but do not fool yourself, and do not let them fool you. It is basically an old-fashioned vanity publishing deal. You are paying someone to publish you, and even if that entity is a division, a separate autonomous division within a company like Simon & Schuster or Hay House or whatever.
We don't want to mention names.
Well, all of these, you know, random, they all have
all
their
of them
now
have.
Self. Yeah, most of the big houses and many of the medium-sized houses have self-publishing units, okay? So I don't have to mention their names. They're all there. And they're not there because they want to rip you off, okay?
No.
Their contracts are straight. Their contracts are not deceptive. They would be sued by the FTC otherwise. I mean, there's no way they could be deceiving you. But you can self-deceive is what I'm saying.
Right.
You are not getting a publishing contract if you are paying the company. Whether you're paying them $100 or $100,000, you are basically buying into a vanity deal. And the biggest problem with vanity deals is they offer absolutely no genuine distribution opportunity. And that's where they get deceptive, in my opinion. And that's where it's controversial. And that's where I could get in a debate with some of these so-called hybrid self-publishing companies, because theoretically they could say they're offering you a distribution opportunity. But in reality, the distribution almost never materializes because companies like Barnes & Noble and the mom-and-pop bookstores are not interested in taking any kind of chance in stocking and creating inventory of vanity books.
But the other way to do it, which is strategic, legitimate, and good business, is to become a writer entrepreneur.
That's different.
Exactly. So if you are going to avail yourself of author services, whether it's through Off the Bookshelf and you're going to go and get recommendations for editors who are going to polish your work, you know, and then you develop your own platform through creating a marketing plan and strategy. If you do all of that, it's different because you are becoming, it's a real do-it-yourself. You may yes. have people who can do, you may have places that can set you up with the printer, and they can set you up with your ebook and your PDF. But if you look at yourself as being an independent author, as opposed to a vanity author, and you know that your job is to find your audience, that's very different.
It's not just your audience. You need to create your customers.
Right.
Your audience has to
be customers.
Yes. Your audience has to be converted into customers. The reason why 50 Shades of Grey, I can't tell you exactly what they did because I don't know, but the reason why it became a bestseller without having to have any kind of traditional publishing support was because they managed to get people to go to the stores and demand that the stores make the book available. Consumers told the stores, Barnes & Noble, big box stores like Kmart and Walmart, et cetera, and as far and of course all the digital resources, they said, we want to buy this book, make it available to us. And when that happens,
right.
Barnes & Noble will bend over backwards to open an account with you.
Exactly.
They will come to you.
Exactly. So your focus needs to be on, as an independent author, is to market yourself, build a platform, brand yourself as an author, find ways to target your audience, and even if you're a traditionally published author, these are the things you need to be doing now in order to rise above all of the competition. Yeah, some books are just more appealing than others. They hit the nerve of what people want at the moment. But in other ways, they're just there and they reach the right people and they know how to sell books.
And, you know, the biggest competition is noise. It's not quality. I mean, yes, of course, on a certain level, you're going to run up against quality. But it's not always the best product that generates the best sales. We know that, and it's not just something that's true to books. It's true in any industry that's ever existed in the world, because you need to compete against people's own preference for distraction, for not wanting to pay attention because there's just too much noise. So if you find a way to get a person's attention and then you are able to convert that attention into them wanting to use their resources, their money, to buy your product, you have accomplished something that's amazing. And now you are a member of the marketplace.
Absolutely. It's really basic business. You know, it's finding a way to distinguish yourself. Marketing today is very different. We've spoken about this in some of our earlier shows. It's not like I see a lot of people on WayNet and on other sites who just broadcast, check out my new book, check out my new book, check out my new book, look at this. You know, and it's like it becomes annoying and people tune it out. So the new way is engagement. Creating relationships with people, maybe even providing them with content to get to know you, and finding a way to be distinguishable from all the other things that are saying, look at me, read me, buy me. It requires more strategy and more willingness to be, you know, to be there and to be consistent and to wait for relationships to be formed as opposed to just broadcasting.
And, you know, I would actually advise anybody who wants to be commercially published to go back and just start watching all the back shows and the ones to follow of that show, Mad Men. you know, even if you don't like all the melodrama and the soap opera stuff, because what that show does in every episode or most of the episodes, they usually have a good 10, 15 minutes dedicated to real, genuinely well-researched marketing plays, screenplay material of what marketing professionals have to do to figure out how to take basic, mundane consumer products and increase market share or just generate some kind of market share. And this is a show that goes back, you know, they're showing how it was done in the 60s. But the kinds of conversations they are having on a conceptual level, I don't think are that much different than the kinds of conversations that would be people are having today about how to conceptually market anything. You know, I mean, of course,
yeah,
now it's different technology.
I mean, but what they did then, advertising and marketing is in flux now, because back then they didn't have a real way to create word of mouth, because what they had that we don't have is they had the same number of people sitting in front of the same television show at the same time.
There were three channels, three or four channels.
Right. And now you take the
same – radio was viable back then.
Radio was viable. But for example, it took something like 30 years for people to actually buy into radio. And it took you know, maybe like – 1 year for everybody to have mobile devices. You know, technology is moving really, really fast. So you have to use the idea of how to figure out a market, which you certainly can. Boy, it's like being in a think tank when you watch that show. That's why you know, we both love it so much. And then utilizing the new technology, which allows you to actually create word of mouth among real people who are going to find that their peers and their peers' opinions are more valuable than sitting in front of a television and having ads thrown at them. It's so awesome. There are things you can do now that they only wished they could have done.
And it's important to remember that the one technology that has not changed is the human technology. Our brains are essentially the same as they were, as far as I know, 40 years ago. And they're probably going to be more or less the same 40 years from now, because human evolution doesn't happen that quickly. So it's really a question of how to use the new opportunities, or how to understand the new opportunities to, for lack of a better word, exploit or manipulate or penetrate the human technology.
It's really about credibility and trust now. You know, that's the first thing people want. People are tired of having misinformation or being so – they're a little more I think – I wouldn't say sophisticated, but they either want to be – they have more expectations that you're either going to be entertaining, you're going to give them something they want that's useful for them. You know, they're not – they don't want to just be – fed things as if they're trained monkeys. You know, they want to be courted a little bit more, you know, because what happened, and I saw this yesterday at a restaurant, people are feeling very empowered because, let's say with a mobile device, there's this app called Yelp. And a lot of times when you, Jeff, you and I are at a restaurant, you see me looking down at my little mobile device, I'm actually looking at Yelp and looking up reviews. And people are feeling powerful because you can be sitting in real time in a restaurant, and if you don't like something that's going on, you check in on your app. You got all these people who are connected with you. You write a review in real time. You are affecting people's decisions. So everybody is becoming a curator and an opinion maker, and it's really interesting. So, you know, again, those are things where somebody might agree more with a review on Yelp than an advertisement for that restaurant. So, you know, those are ways that people can use the new technologies to make sure, first of all, that they know what people are saying about them, and there are ways to do that, And to also take charge of what information is out there. It's, you know, it's just, it's different. I think we've been finding that we're connecting and networking with people in many different ways now.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's interesting, like this thing called LinkedIn, which has grown tremendously over the years, and it went public a couple of years ago, which gave them a huge amount of capital to make it huge. And everything, as far as I mean, there are things you could pay for, but I've never given them a dime, but I must have thousands of passive connections from it, just people who reach out to me through it and say, hey, I want to connect with you. And if I ever go through my membership list on the, or whatever it is, my friend list, whatever they call it on LinkedIn, all of a sudden I realize that, there's 2,000 people here, and maybe like 50% of them are people I could actually do business with.
I might not have known.
I may never have found them, you know, or thought of the, and people are finding me, you know, and saying, you know, I saw you on LinkedIn and I looked you up and, you know, maybe you and now, you know, here's my idea for a book. And so there's all kinds of networking opportunities that are provided. And yeah, I think for $50 a month, you could, like, you would with LinkedIn, the way it works is you say, I want to find literary agents and book editors. And for $50 a month, what LinkedIn will do, maybe, I haven't tried it, is they will feed you every literary agent that's a member.
There are ways to do that research.
Saying LinkedIn spoon feeds it. So, and which is why it's a $1 billion company or something, you know. And I don't know exactly, you know, what their technique is, but I'm just saying that I'm not saying this is the way to use them, but it's why they're successful.
Well, and also, you know, everybody, one of the things I really want to stress with people is that when they're creating a strategy, they don't have to use every one of these new platforms in trying to create an internet footprint for themselves, because I think people become very overwhelmed that there is, you know, so much out there. I have an announcement. I'm about to relaunch my spiritual writing from inspiration to publication book, and I actually go into a lot of how to set up your marketing strategy through digital platforms in the book. It was updated for the digital, for the new digital world, and also it's going to be published through Off the Bookshelf, you know, as another way of introducing the new company. But you know, what I want to stress is that not every platform is right for every type of writer, for every type of business person. You know, for you, for example, Jeff, you can and will do more on LinkedIn because people in the industry, they know you as an agent. There's more business oriented toward the literary agency on LinkedIn, whereas some of these other platforms, like, for example, if you were a children's book author, you might want to use a lot of Pinterest. That's a great platform, you know, and maybe Twitter is better for certain people to connect and network there. And some people just don't get Twitter. It's like, what is it, a bird? You know, but for many businesses, Twitter is the best platform. You know, so you really don't need to do everything all at once. You know, you got to find the things that you like and stick with them. And you like Waynet, right, Jeff?
It's amazing.
And that's why where you have fun, because you get to start discussions, you get to meet other writers and find out what's on their minds. And we've also found some good books on Waynet.
Oh,
keep
yes.
Keep luck there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's a, you know, it's a great social network.
But, you know, we should talk a little bit about Off the Bookshelf, because what makes offthebookshelf.com so unique is that we will not make any money if someone self-publishes through it. Am I correct? It's basically...
No.
No, we will make a commission if they sell product through it. But they can sell...
I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
no,
they can
no, Jeff,
digitize...
That would actually mean that we are the worst entrepreneurs on earth.
No, it means we're
yes,
the best.
Yes, we are totally... We're a charity. No.
No. We're the best because we're enabling people to do something that most other businesses in this so-called area are charging a lot of money and making.
Right, I was just teasing.
Right.
The way it works is we have several aspects to the site. If a person has a manuscript that's ready to go, they can, or if they just want to be part of an independent writing community and they want to read books or review books. Or if they're an industry insider and they want to find books that perhaps they want to bring to a higher level, they can join. There's no charge for that. If a person wants to upload a completed manuscript and they really believe it's ready and that it's viable, we have free proprietary conversion software that will take a Word doc. It's ready to be launched. We're just making sure it has no bugs because we want it to be the best possible. But it'll convert a Word doc into what's called EPUB, which is used for either a PDF.
And we have a patent. There's a patent on this.
Right.
Which has been,
and it's
this is a $100,000 – I want to say this because this proprietary technology, which is unique to us, has cost about $100,000 to develop.
No,
and
more.
Or more, excuse me.
But anyway – to do the site now would be ridiculous. But what we offer on the site is somebody can take a book and they can upload it with the software. It converts it into EPUB or an ebook, okay? And it makes it really nice. I mean, it'll look like any book. You could even use that for print on demand. So we have a relationship with a printer, so you can have people order books print on demand.
Hey, but to this point, we have not made a dime, correct? They have now taken their manuscript and turned it into a digital product that can also be recreated print on demand with a cover. They can choose covers. They can customize.
We have a free cover generator software.
Right.
That was also
for us. And how much money have we made on it so far?
Zero. Nothing.
Right. So services that they may have to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars for elsewhere have so far been provided for free.
Then we have a mass distribution engine, which will take their book and put it on all of the retail sites for them. They can take it and put it on their own site too, and then, or they can sell their book from their own page where they can have a blog and they can have a profile and everything on the Off the Bookshelf site.
And they'll share a little of the revenue with us.
Right. We have a set amount that we take per book, which is nominal. And then what we also offer is they set their own profit and price point within, you know, we make suggestions for what's going to actually be good for them so they can
sell
their
book. And we never
touch
their money.
And they – no, and they are their own independent contractor. And once they reach like, I don't know, a nominal amount in their own account, they can cash out.
Right. And what happens to the money when someone buys a book? Do we touch it?
No.
No. Right. It goes directly into their account, however they designate it. They
right.
never have to ask us to collect or send them a dime. If they sell the book through our site, through the engine that we're providing for free, they
The mass distribution engine does have a charge, but it's like ridiculously low.
Okay, so it's basically a break-even charge.
Yes, it's just to cover some licenses, I think.
Right. Now, they could price their book, let's say, at $4.99 digital.
Or whatever.
Someone goes on PayPal through LinkedIn. Off the bookshelf, and they pay with their credit card, their $4.99. How much of that $4.99 does the author get directly? Not through us, but directly from PayPal or whoever the collection.
On an ebook?
Yeah.
they would get $3.99.
Right. So they get $3.99. We got and off the bookshelf gets $1.
Yes.
Is that what it is? Okay. So everything
never changes.
Right. And that's how we will be compensated. So which I guess represents about 20% of a four. But if they price the book at $9.99 for whatever reason, because they think they can get it, and the book sells for $9.99, how much does off the bookshelf get out of that $9.99?
$1.
$1, right.
For an
eagle. Yes, now you're getting 90%. So basically as a administrative fee and for creating this venue and for doing what could cost thousands and thousands of dollars for an author to have to recreate the wheel doing or through somebody else, they're really not – it's such a more profitable model for the author.
Well, and I want to point out some other things. What we're gathering with our site is information also. We want to do what Jeff and Deborah Herman have done for our 20 years or so in the business, which is to educate writers to be successful with these books. I've been creating something called Writer Entrepreneur. It's a new blog, and it'll be launched soon. If anybody wants to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Digital Deborah, which is spelled digital, and then D-E-B-O-R-A-H. And you can join our mailing list by going to jeffherman.com, and I'll be making an announcement, or you can join, let me know. We have another site that's going to be within Writer Entrepreneur called Book Marketing Academy. And another thing that we're going to be offering is referrals to editors, because we want to make sure that people, and they don't have to do it, but we recommend, and these are outside editors, we recommend that people put their best foot forward. We also will have referrals to people who can give custom interior design, though you don't need it with this software. But if somebody's doing a poetry book, they want something a little fancier, we can refer them to graphic designers. And if they want a custom cover, the same thing. We've got people that we can refer them to. And we're gathering the best of the best and people who are affordable so that they can continue marketing and selling their books, because we all benefit. And so thank you for bringing that up. I'm very proud of it. I am the CEO of offthebookshelf.com. You can find
– Yeah, I work for Deb.
Yes. You're my consultant. And, of course, join us both at Waynet. We're going to be it's been a little bit low-key, but we're going to be relaunching everything together this summer. And so we welcome you to join us at waenet.com. There's a place for new ideas, start discussions. Let us know what you want to learn so that you can have a successful writing and publishing career, because it's good for you, it's good for the economy, and it's good for this country and the world for new and unique voices to have a means through which to reach their audience. It's all good. We love publishing. We love books. Anything to add, Jeff?
Be excited and feel great about it. Just get energized and be motivated and know that you create your own limits.
Absolutely. So don't create any limits. Let's manifest an amazing future for all of us. That's all for tonight at Off the Bookshelf Radio. We will be back next week with an author guest. I will be announcing it on Facebook and on my page on BBS Radio. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to hearing from you next week. Good night, Jeff.
Good night,
listeners.
Good night, listeners.